Okay, so welcome everybody. So the speaker for this strong gravity seminar today is Josu from King's College London. So Josu is, I believe, a graduate student there, and he has worked on a number of interesting problems related to cosmic streams, inflation, testing, gravity, etc. I think today he will talk about the gravitational waveform and the memory effect from cosmic streams. Okay.
That's right. Yep. Hi, everyone. Thanks very much for inviting me. So yes, today I'm going to be talking about gravitational waves from cosmic streams, which is work that I've done. It's a big part of my PhD. And this work that I've done with Thomas Helfer, which is a postdoc in Johns Hopkins University, and Eugene Lim, which is my supervisor at King's. And it's based on these two papers that I'm showing you here. So I'm going to start just showing you a summary movie, which is going to explain what we are going to be looking at in this talk. So what we are going to be looking at are the first gravitational waveforms from cosmic stream loops. So I hope you can see this movie here. In particular, when we are going to focus in these circular loops that are shown here, right? And using the adaptive mesh refinement capability for a year Chombo, we are going to evolve this system and extract the gravitational waves. So if I stop the movie here, right, you can see on the top part, this is the energy density of the string loop that is going to evolve in a second. And here on the bottom, I'm showing you the 2-0 mode of the plus polarization of the strain, how it evolves with time. So if I play this, you can see that the loop starts to collapse, accelerates, and then after some point, an apparent horizon is formed. So we have a black hole there, and this black hole ring downs after the merger and emits these gravitational waves that we want to extract and model. Okay, so if I go back to the slides. First of all, so what are cosmic strings? So cosmic strings are topological defects that are expected to have been formed in the very early universe. So they are stable matter configurations that they form during a phase transition, right? So they usually form in a network. So you can see here that you have many of these strings. This network evolves, exchange partners, so that you can form these closed loops here. Some of them will oscillate, and other ones will collapse, as we will see later. So they are very interesting because they provide a unique link to the very early universe, and they are a source of gravitational waves. And in fact, they are one of the key targets of the LIGO Virgo and Calder detectors, also LISA in the future. So how do they form? So I made this animation that I think quite explains well how these topological defects can form. So first, we are going to study domain walls, which are just two-dimensional topological defects. So imagine that in the very early universe, we have some scalar potential here with some minima that has some set to symmetry, right? Our universe is happy to be at this point because it's the less energetic configuration. As the universe expands, right, what we see is that the temperature drops and temperature corrections might break the symmetry of this potential by generating these two degenerate vacua here, right? So our universe that was initially at this point here is not happy to be here anymore because it wants to fall into these less energetic configurations, right? So on the left-hand side here, I'm showing you the same plot, but on the right-hand side, I'm showing you the universe. So you can think of it as different causally disconnected patches, right? Different Hubble patches that you can see here. These ones cannot talk to each other. So what can happen is that some parts of the universe will fall into the pink vacuum, and other ones will fall into the blue vacuum, as you can see here. So now if you imagine that you are at this blue region here and you want to walk in space to the pink region, what this corresponds in field space is to climbing up the potential and going down. So we see that in the boundary between these two regions, what we have is some trapped energy. And this is what we call domain walls. So cosmic strings are a generalization where instead of breaking a set two symmetry, we break a U1 symmetry. So instead of having just two degenerate vacua, we have an infinite number of vacua that you can see here. So again, if we have our universe that is formed by different Hubble patches, what we see is that some regions may fall in the pink one, other ones in the green. And then what we can see here is that some specific points have some very specific features, such as this one here, right? That you can see that if we go around this point here, the field is doing pink, orange, green, and blue. So it's really going around the potential, the minimum of the potential. So this is what we call having a winding number one. If it went in the other direction, it will have a winding number minus one. So if again, we want to walk towards this point here, in this space, we are just going up in the potential. So again, we have some trapped energy here. And this is what we call a cosmic string. So you can think of an infinite string by stacking just different slices of such as this one here. Good. So people have studied the formation. You can see in this movie how from random initial configurations, you can form these strings that intersect and evolve. And let me play that again. You see that you can form these loops here. Let's see, this one loop here, another one up here, but let's look at this one that collapses, all right? So most of these simulations have been done in flat space or expanding background. So they are not taking any back reaction or any gravitational effects. And cosmic strings are actually quite an old topic in the sense that people have been studying them for 30, 40 years. And the two main approaches to evolve these networks are these ones here. The field theory approach, where basically you have your theory and you can discretize it and solve it in a lattice. So the good thing about this approach is that you take into account all the field interactions. However, some criticisms are that the strings might not be well resolved. So if you think about putting a string in a lattice, right? Here I'm showing you the lattice. And then if this box expands because you want to simulate the expansion of the universe, what may happen is that the string might fall within the resolution or below the resolution of your code. So many times they try to do some approximations, but I don't think there is full agreement if those can be applied. Then we have the Nambu-Goto approach, which I think is the most popular one, which is based on assuming that these strings are really one-dimensional objects. So if you compare the length of these strings to their size, which is very, very small, you can model this as just one-dimensional objects. So the good thing about this is that they can simulate very large systems. The simulations are cheaper. Maybe one of the criticisms could be that as they are not evolving the fields, maybe in some places they are not capturing all the physics. But the main problem between these two approaches is that they don't agree in the results. So the main energy loss mechanism is different if you evolve a network using field theory or if you evolve a network using Nambu-Goto. And along these lines, there has been some recent work by Amelia Drew and Paul Shelard in Cambridge where they study field theory using adaptive mesh refinements so that they don't have this problem of the resolution.
Excuse me, do you mind if I interrupt with a question?
Yeah, of course.
So can you elaborate on what you just said about the Nambu-Goto string not capturing all the physics? So what might be missing?
Right. So what I understood, I'm not an expert on Nambu-Goto, is that if you have two strings that are colliding, they are not this reconnection that happens in strings. They do it by hand in the sense that they know that if you have one string that is crossing like this, they know, okay, this pair has to go with this pair and this other pair has to go with this other pair, right? So in that sense, they are not seeing how the intercommutation happens in Nambu-Goto. So if okay. I have two strings that they, imagine two Nambu-Goto strings, if they pass really, really close to each other, but they don't touch, in Nambu-Goto, they would not have an effect. Like they would not see each other. Whereas in field theory, right, if you send them two, you probably would have field interaction, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Thanks.
Yeah, perfect. No worries. So in our work, what we are going to be doing is adding general relativity for the first time. And on top of that, we are going to be using adaptive mesh refinement. So here I'm going to show you a simulation where you can see how adaptive mesh refinement is really a powerful tool to use here. So this is a loop that is collapsing, but you cannot see the loop because you see how all the adaptive mesh refinement is just resolving the string core. that it doesn't fall, it doesn't go below the resolution of our grid. Right. So in our approach, we have some good news and some bad news as before. So the good points of what we are doing is that we can capture the field interactions because we are evolving the fields, but also with full back reaction effects. So this allows us to study cosmic strings in strong gravity phenomena. So for example, black hole formation, or maybe more important for LIGO and Virgo, extracting waveforms. The bad news of our approach is that we have some computational limitations. So we cannot simulate the full network yet, as people do in Nambu-Goto or just in field theory. For us, it's too expensive. So as we will see later, what we are going to be doing is just focusing on just one event. So one loop or one cusp, but not the full network. And the motivation for our work is, I mean, as you probably know, is the detections from gravitational waves in 2015. So here I'm showing you the strain data in Hanford and Livingston detectors and how it beautifully matches with a template that was constructed from two binary black holes, right? So you see that matches perfectly the data. So our hope is, if we go again to the raw data of Hanford and Livingston, sorry, and we construct templates from other exotic objects. So in our case, it's cosmic strings, but it could be boson stars. And if we scan this data with these new waveforms, maybe we can detect new objects, right? Good. So similar as it was done in binary black holes, right? We have detected many individual events, about 50, I think, by now. But there is no detection of stochastic background. So in cosmic strings, right, for the last many years, 30 years, people have been focusing on the stochastic background. So most of the constraints that people have on strings are based on stochastic background. So evolving all the network and see how the gravitational waves from that system would look like. We are not going to be focusing on this. So what we are going to be looking at is at individual events, as I said. So a loop that collapses and forms a black hole, for example. Okay, are there any questions at this point?
Yeah, maybe I have a question here. So yeah. It looks like the waveform you showed earlier is very similar to the waveform of head-on black hole collision.
Perfect. I will reply that in like, I think 30 minutes, 20 minutes.
Okay.
If that's okay. Yeah, I will go into that. Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
So the numerical setup, right? If we want to evolve cosmic strings with full general relativity, what we're going to be using is numerical relativity. So basically solving Einstein's equation in a computer. We're going to be using the 3+1 decomposition, where this is the metric, right? So basically our space, and we're going to slice it with three-dimensional hyperslices so that we can evolve the system as an initial value problem. So we specify some initial data, and then we evolve with some evolution equations. So here gamma ij is the three metric. So it's the intrinsic metric to these hyperslices. And then we have the laps and the shifts, which are dynamical gauge variables, which actually are going to be very important if you want to evolve stable black hole spacetimes. We also have the extrinsic curvature here, which is approximately the time derivative of the three metric here, and encodes the information of how our hyperslice is embedded into the full spacetime. And then if we take the trace of this extrinsic curvature tensor, we have the expansion, which for those that are more familiar with FRW, this will correspond to the Hubble parameter. We're going to have a projector that is going to project quantities that live on the full spacetime into hyper quantities in the three-dimensional hyperslice. So if we do that to Einstein's equations, we get the standard four constraint equations, so the Hamiltonian and momentum constraints. So here you can see that R is the Ricci scalar associated to the three metric, gamma ij. And then we are going to have here rho and si, which are the energy density and momentum density. So these are different projections of your energy momentum tensor. And in the case of black holes, this would vanish. So you only need to solve for this. So something that you can see here is that these are constraint equations in the sense that they have to be satisfied at all times. So if you want to be solving a GR problem, your initial data has to satisfy these constraints. So regarding evolution equations, I'm not going to go into much detail, but we are using the BSSM formulation, which has been proven to provide long stable simulations. And our approach is going to be basically, we specify some initial data that satisfies the constraints, and then we evolve. Good. So regarding the matter sector, we are going to be simulating Abelian-Higgs theory, which is one of the most popular theories for cosmic strings. So if we see here the Lagrangian, what we have is a complex scalar field here and a gauge field. We are going to have some current where d mu is the gauge derivative, which is going to be set by some electric charge. We are going to fix this just to one number, so we are not going to vary it in our simulations. The potential we are using is the standard Mexican hat potential, where lambda is the coupling constant. And the most important parameter, or the one that we are going to be varying in our simulations, is eta, which is the symmetry breaking scale. And if you ever heard the talk about cosmic strings, you probably heard about the string tension, which is the most important quantity. This is a dimensionless number where mu is the energy per unit length, and it's related to the symmetry breaking scale squared. So if we can put constraints on the string tension of the strings, we can learn something about the symmetry breaking scale. So we also have another constraint, which is the Gauss constraint. Again, that needs to be satisfied at all times. And to have a stable simulations of this system, we're gonna be using the Knapp-Walker-Baumgartner formalism, where we are gonna introduce an auxiliary variable set, which is gonna change the properties of our system of equations. And it's gonna assure that this constraint is satisfied at all times by using a damping constant here. I will drive this set to zero. So how to? Once we have this decomposition done and we code these evolution equations and the initial data, we can study different phenomena. So for example, if we want to study an infinite static string, we solve the constraints for that initial data and we evolve. If we want to solve a circular string loop, we solve the constraints and then we evolve. So the first thing we're gonna be looking at is the infinite static string. And as the name says, it is static, so it's not gonna be really exciting, but we can use it as a robust test of our equations. So here I am showing you in the left-hand side, a sketch of this string, which has periodic boundary conditions in set, right? So if we want to solve for the initial data, we see that we can put some ansatz that is cylindrically symmetric for the scalar field, the gauge field, and also for the metric. And the way we're gonna solve for the initial data is by solving the matter equations that come from the Lagrangian of the matter field and Einstein equations. So first we are gonna solve fields in flat space background. Once we have the fields in flat space, the solution, we can construct the energy momentum tensor and solve for the metric using Einstein's equations. Once we have this new metric, we can solve for the fields in this new metric background. Once we have this, we can again reconstruct what the energy momentum tensor is and solve for the new metric and iterate. So we're gonna be iterating here until we see some convergence in our solutions. Once we have that, we can export this initial data and read it in our 3+1 code. So here I'm showing you a simulation in our 3+1 code where you can see the energy density of a static string that has, as I said, periodic boundary conditions along the set direction. And you can see that time is passing, but nothing is going on. So even though this looks boring, this is a really good thing because it is an infinite static string. So that's what one would expect. So our code seems to be working. And we can quantify this even more by looking how the constraints are performing. So here I'm showing you the L2H norm of the Hamiltonian constraint. So you see that it starts at 10^-8, and not only is small, but it is driven to even smaller values and it remains stable. So here I'm showing you how the Gauss constraint is behaving. So one thing that you can see is that if we don't introduce a damping, there is this linear growth in the constraint, which is not good. But if we introduce the damping that we mentioned, we can stabilize it. Good, so now that we have our code and we are happy about it, We know that it's working. We track the constraints. We can study a bit more interesting phenomena, such as the cosmic string loop collapse. So as I said, again, we need to find the initial data. So for the matter fields, what we are going to be doing is identifying the periodicity along the set direction that we have for an infinite static string with a periodicity in theta. So this is basically like taking a string, cutting it, and stitching it together to form a closed loop. So as you can see here, this loop still has lots of symmetry. So if I take a 2D slice, you can see that this basically looks as a string that is going out of the screen in one direction, and then it goes into the screen in here, right? Using polar coordinates, we can just simplify this to some string that is r distance from the center. And for solving the gravity part, or the initial data for gravity, we are going to use some conformally flat ansatz. So you can see that 1 over chi, or chi, is going to be our conformal factor. So we can solve the Hamiltonian constraint using this equation here, where rho is going to be the energy density of a string that is r distance away from the center. So if we plug this three metric into here, right, we are going to get some differential equation for chi that we can solve. So the momentum constraints are trivially satisfied because we are choosing that our loop is initially stationary. So we don't need to worry about that. Good. So just as a recap, for one string, we only had one parameter, or we're only going to change one parameter, which was the string tension. So if you change the string tension, you are making the mass of the string larger by increasing the string tension. For the loop, we have another parameter, which is the radius of the loop. So not only increasing the string tension will increase the mass, but also if we increase the radius, the length of the loop is larger, so we have more mass. So this is something that you can see here. So if I have a loop, a circular loop such as this one, I have that its mass is 2 pi r, so the length of the loop times the mass per unit length, mu. So what we are gonna see is that this loop has some tension. So it's like a rubber band. It wants to collapse, right? So there's gonna be some tension that is gonna push everything to collapse. And then what we want to study with our simulations is what's going to happen here. I mean, I already told you that we can form a black hole, but this would be the two results that we can get, right? So here I'm showing you same string tension, but different radius. So one is more massive than the other one. So if we look at the left-hand side one, we can see that the loop collapses and winds. So there is no loop, no string anymore, and emits all the energy, right? So we say that this loop has dispersed. Whereas in this one, we see that the black hole has formed. We can track that just by checking for an apparent horizon. So why is this happening? So why is this one forming a black hole, and why this one is dispersing so that there is no loop? So we can think of it as follows. So as I said before, if we take a 2D slice, this looks like two strings, one that is going out of the screen and another one that is going inside into the screen, right? So this is like a string that has winding number minus one and another one that has winding number plus one. So the total winding number is zero. What this means is that this configuration is topologically unstable. So the string doesn't want to be there. It wants to unwind and emit all the energy. So if we look at what parameters we have here, which scales, we have here the string width, delta, and the radius of the loop. Then given these parameters, if I know what the Schwarzschild radius is, which I'm drawing it here, right? Which is 2 times the mass of the loop. So then this loop collapses. We see that not all the energy can fall within the Schwarzschild radius, and then the plus one winding number and the minus one cancel each other. So the string unwinds and emits all the energy. If I make the loop larger, just by increasing the radius, the thickness is still the same. The radius is larger, so the mass is larger too, and we can see that the Schwarzschild radius is larger too. In this case, the loop collapses, falls within its Schwarzschild radius, and forms a black hole. So using the Hoppe conjecture, we can know when black hole can, or we can get a condition, right? So we want that the Schwarzschild radius is larger than the string width. So using that, we can get the condition for the radius of the loop. Right? So if you give me some string tension, I can tell you how what is the radius you need to form a black hole, right? So what you can see here is that if you make the loop, if you make the string tension very low, so if the mass per unit length is very small, you need a larger and larger radius to form a black hole. So if we think about black holes that are observable with LIGO Virgo Kagra, which are about 100 solar masses, and based on current constraints of string tension, which is 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 10, the radius we need to form a black hole is about the solar system size. So about 100 astronomical units, which is pretty small compared to the size of the universe. Good. So something that we did was also checking this this prediction we made using the Hoppe conjecture, right? So this is the parameter space I'm showing you, the string tension g mu and the radius of the loop. So in purple, I'm showing you the black hole formation estimate. So if I choose some parameters that fall within this region here, I should form a black hole. And this is what you can see in the black and yellow dots, right? Black ones are the ones in which we observe a black hole in our simulations. And in orange or yellow, you can see the dispersion cases. So they fit pretty well to this formula that we got. So something else we can do is compare this to Nambu-Goto. As I said, the approximation that considers that the strings are one-dimensional, so they are extremely thin, infinitesimally thin. So for those loops, the circular loops would behave such as this one. So it's like a cosine with T over R. So this is what I'm showing you here, right? At T equals to zero, the loop has some initial radius and then collapses. So what you can see is that in our simulations, right, if we track the radius of the loop, it follows pretty much a Nambu-Goto until it reaches about the thickness of the loop. In that case, you cannot consider the string one-dimensional because you have to take into account the curvature. So then you can see that it deviates. What is really remarkable here is that when the black hole forms, or when the string has collapsed, it is collapsing at really highly ultra-relativistic speeds, so up to 0.97c in this case. And as we will see later, this can go up to 0.9999c. So these are very ultra-relativistic events.
Joshua?
So yeah,
what
sorry?
Is this velocity?
Yeah.
What is this velocity?
So the loop starts at velocity zero, but what happens is that it gets accelerated due to the tension.
But is it
so this velocity is when the loop has reached its thickness, or when it forms the black hole.
So it's the radius of the loop that is shrinking?
That's yes, exactly. So this is the loop, you have the loop like that. Is,
okay.
Does it make sense? I cannot hear you properly. I think it's very...
No,
yeah?
I was trying to understand what is it? This is the velocity of shrinking, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the center of mass of the loop is... zero velocity, but then you have the loop that is collapsing, and then when it collapses, when it reaches this time here, it collides. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Is that clear? Any other question here?
Yeah, I have a question. I mean, that was harsh. So have you looked at what happens at the threshold of black hole formation? I mean, have you tried to find critical phenomena and
yes,
all
actually,
those good things?
I have a backup slide for that, but I don't know if I can show it later. Maybe I can show it later. But yeah, we did chop to it collapse. And we try to get like what is the exponent. So the problem for that is that you need really high-res simulations, right? So we did get an exponent, but the error bar was really huge. So for chop to collapse, right, for just scalar field, I think it's 0.37, if I remember right. I think we got something between 0.24 and 0.40. So I don't think we could conclude anything there.
Okay, no, that's very nice, yeah.
Okay, so if we look at, now we know that the loop can collapse and form a black hole. So now what we want to look at is gravitational waves from this event, right? So imagine that we are here and we have a loop that is some distance away from us. So this loop collapses, forms a black hole, and we expect that this black hole is going to be radiating gravitational waves. So what we want to know is how does this look like from Earth? So if I show you this slide, let's see, is it working? Okay, so here I'm showing you the 2-0 mode of the real part of a Neumann-Penrose scalar, which is normalized with mass. So something that you can see here is that you have some merger and then the standard bring down. This is for a loop that has this string tension here, 6 × 10⁻³ and 350. Something that you can see here is that we have this initial junk radiation, which is the, I mean, it's quite expected. You also have this for binary black holes. The problem is that our loop is colliding, it's really collapsing at ultra-relativistic speed, so we cannot split very well this from the merger. Okay, so now something that we can do is just, okay, let's fix the string tension and vary the string radius, right? So we have different size loops. So what we find, and this was actually quite surprising, is that the mass normalized waveform, right, of this event is more or less the same, approximately the same. So no matter how big the loop is, if you fix the string tension, you will have the same mass normalized waveform. This is very nice if you want to build templates for LIGO, for example, because you can just assume that it's scaling with M or with the radius in this case. So what we found is that if you change R, it is weakly dependent. So what we
Joshua, then
what
we
yeah.
Yeah, can you ask you why did you think that that was surprising? I mean, I like to hear the argument that on the opposite direction. Is it?
Maybe what I would say is that what I'm going to show you now was surprising. And I mean, we were expecting that if you change the radius of the loop, right, you are changing the mass of the system. So maybe if you have some system that has more mass, it should maybe emit more gravitational waves. I think we were just naive. I'm thinking, oh yeah, maybe why should it be the same, right? I don't know.
I need to think about this.
But yeah, in any case, I think we understood why this is happening. So I'm gonna explain that in 2 slides.
All right, thank you.
But yeah, no problem. What we found really interesting is this plot here. So here we are changing also G mu. So we are changing the string tension. And of course we have to change the radius so that it forms a black hole, right? So what you can see here is that, of course, in this case, you can see clearly said that some events are louder than the other ones. What is really interesting here is that the ones that are the loudest are the ones that have lower string tensions. So the strings that couple less to gravity produce more gravitational waves. This was really surprising, right? Because the constraints push this number to 10⁻⁵, 10⁻⁷, 10⁻⁷. And this is telling us that if you have a loop with that string tension, it is producing more gravitational waves. So something that you can also see here, right? I mean, the red one is the lowest string tension and the blue one is the highest one. Something that you can see also is that if you increase the radius of the loop, it takes longer to collapse. And then in that way you can split better the junk radiation that you can see here. So why is this happening?
Go.
So why is this happening? Okay, so the reason or the way we found this makes sense is because as we saw Nambu-Goto, I mean, our simulations agree with Nambu-Goto, and Nambu-Goto predicts that the radius of the loop is collapsing as, or is behaving as a cosine, right? So if you take the derivative from here, you can see that the velocity is just gonna be sine of T over R. Then black hole formation happens when the radius of the loop, right, gets to the Schwarzschild radius, which is given here. So from here, I can solve at which time this happens. And once I have at which time is this happening, I can know what the velocity is at this time. So I think this is what you were asking before, like what is this velocity? This is the one that I meant. The velocity of the string when it reaches the Schwarzschild radius. So if you plug this in here, what you find is that the velocity is square root of 1 − 16π² g mu square. So if you look here, there is no R dependence at all. And maybe the other thing that is interesting is that if you take G mu to smaller values, so if you take G mu to 0, your strings are colliding at higher velocities. So this is something that you can see here, that the Lorentz contraction of the string, it goes as 1/T mu. And this also shows why these simulations are actually quite expensive if you go to lower values of the string tension, because you have huge Lorentz contractions that you have to resolve. So from this argument, we concluded that the gravitational waves are not dominated by geometry in the sense that if you make the loop larger, it doesn't change it. But what really matters is the kinematics. So the velocity at which the string is moving when the black hole forms. Okay. So we did track this. So here I'm showing you the energy.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you go back to your slide with all the waveforms superposed?
This one?
Right. So, okay. So the previous one.
So sorry. I think it's my laptop. Why doesn't want to move? This one.
Right. So M naught for all those cases is about the same. Is that right?
Yeah. So if you compute if you know the string tension, right, and the radius, you can know what the mass is. We didn't make it so that in all of them it's exactly the same. It is about the same. So I think for this one was 19, for this one 17, 16. But what we do then is take our waveform and normalize it with that. So we take the time and we divide over the mass that we got from the apparent horizon.
Okay, so the mass of the black hole being the same explains why the ring down is more or less the same in each case.
No, absolutely, yeah.
And then your argument about the strength of the wave has to do with, so you're saying that the faster the string is at horizon crossing, of course, the more.
Yes.
I mean, the gravitational waves are going to scale with some power of the velocity.
Exactly.
And that velocity scales with the tension, but not
exactly.
with the radius.
Exactly. That's the argument.
Very good.
I'm going to show you now. But yeah. Here, I mean, the reason why I'm scaling everything to the same mass is because then I can compare the amplitudes. Yeah.
Thank you.
And actually, you're absolutely right. This is what I was going to show now.
So why do you put your finger on the velocity and not on the acceleration? It might be just a matter of terminology, because I would picture, so it's the acceleration of the quadrupole that generates the waveforms. So you're looking at the velocity, but the change of velocity is the fastest. Maybe it's also saying that the acceleration is the strongest.
Yeah, that's a good point. I haven't thought about that, but I think that makes sense. Yeah, I think we should see something similar, just trying to explain it with the acceleration. Yeah, but I don't know. Yeah, good point.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. So here I'm showing you in the y-axis the energy that is emitted in gravitation waves compared to the initial mass of the system, right? So for different string tensions. So we see that they are more or less about 2%, right? So if you compare this to other highly symmetric systems, such as the head-on merger, you can see that this is really, really much louder. So head-on merger is about 0.06%, more or less. And in this case, we got it up to 2%. But here is where we see how the energy that is emitted depends on gamma, actually. I think you were saying this before, right? So if I go to lower string tensions, I see how the energy that is emitted in gravitational waves increases. And as I showed before, gamma is proportional to 1/g mu. So it's like the energy with normalized with mass goes as gamma. This is what we find, yeah. Okay, what about the string waveform? So if we want
to ask you one question on the previous slide.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you have an explanation for why it seems to be leveling off the energy in the gravitational waves for the low values of mu instead of like climbing up steeply like the approximation suggests?
So, I mean, this thing here cannot apply to all the range, right? Because this at some point, I think was 10 to the minus or something like that, it will go to infinity. It will be larger than 100%. So that cannot be. So I think we expect here to be like some new scale or something that will balance this, but we haven't been able to explore this more just because simulations are more expensive. Because as I said, if you go to lower values of g mu, you have to resolve the Lorentz contraction. But yeah, we don't know what happens here, but I would not expect this to keep increasing. There should be some maximum value, but we haven't explored that.
Before you said you thought you could get to velocities that were sort of approaching arbitrarily close to the speed of light before you get a black hole.
The velocities can increase up to 0.9999 c. Just depends what the string tension is. The thing is that studying the black hole formation for these cases is very hard. I mean, computationally expensive, I would say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, right, so velocity can. Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, in that case, you might expect to get like a lot more than 2%.
Yeah, maybe. But what I'm saying is that this expression here is only valid for this range, right?
Uh-huh.
It cannot go up to a G mu zero because then you have more than 100 efficiency. But yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
thanks.
No problem. Okay, so if we want to detect this, we need to construct the strain waveform, right? And before spending a lot of time trying to construct it, maybe one thing that we can think of is it degenerate with black hole collisions, right? So for example, if we look at the waveform, we see that there is no in spiral part. So we can already say that, okay, it is not degenerate with in spirals. However, is it degenerate with the same mass binary head-on collision, right? So if I have a loop at the same distance as this one with the same mass, right? And this forms a black hole and this head-on forms another black hole, are they degenerate? So this is what we can see here, right? So we see that the loop is just much louder. So it is not degenerate for this case, for the same distance. And this is not surprising because as we said, the loop is 30 times more energetic, right? So, I mean, the mass is the same, so you have the same frequency, but the amplitudes are different just because it is louder. Okay.
But you can play with the distance.
Yes, very good. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And this is what we did also, right? So again, we consider the same with the same distance, and what we find is this thing here. So for this case, what we found is that if you have a black hole head-on collision that is 16 times closer, more or less, right? You see that the quasi-normal modes are exactly the same. So the rhythm is the same, which makes sense because this is just a Schwarzschild black hole. It's nothing else than that. However, if you have access to the full waveform, right? You can see that the merger and even the pre-merger, it is quite different. So you should be able to distinguish them. So I think this is a... Yeah,
that's have you done the exercise of trying to get waveforms of head-on and assuming you can change arbitrarily the parameters where there is one that will give you will make you think that you're matching with a head-on, a black hole head-on? Because I mean, those two waveforms are sufficiently different.
Yes.
But if you didn't have the templates corresponding to the loop collapse and you're only searching for...
Yes. Actually, I think I will come to that in the last slide because we are not doing it for head-on, but we are considering a very massive spirals where you can only have access to this bit here, right? Where you like only the matter. But I think this might answer the question by Juan that you had this.
Yeah,
they were quite similar, but if you look here, they are not that. I mean, they are quite, but not that much.
Yeah. Well. Have you computed the fidelity between these two curves? I mean,
no, we haven't. No.
Okay, because that will tell you that how different they are and how much SNR you need to distinguish these two waveforms. Yeah.
I think that might answer a bit in the last slide. Yeah.
Okay.
I think I'm running a bit back down. Okay, but if we want to construct the waveform, right, similar to how it's done in binary or in spirals, you have the in spiral, where you can apply Poisson-Tonian techniques, then the merger, where you use numerical relativity, and the ring down, where you have a perturbation theory. So for our case, what we have again is the infall, where we see that the weak field gravity applies. Then the merger, where we are going to be using numerical relativity, and the ring down, where we use perturbation theory. So as I said, here I'm plotting Psi 4, the Neumann-Penrose scalar, not H, but this is approximately the second derivative. So if in principle, I should be able to construct the strain by just integrating this twice. However, if you see at this point here, this little bump is the junk radiation from the initial data. And this is gonna destroy the integration if we want to integrate it twice. So if I take this and integrate twice, we see that we have two constants, right, from the integration. I have to set A to have a finite energy, but then we have the strain plus some shifting, overall shifting. If I integrate this is what I get. Right? So you see here, you have the ring down, the merger, and then all this part here, which you cannot trust because of the junk radiation. So if you want to construct the full waveform, you need to use a different approach here. And this is what we did here for the info. So the standard way I think people do is using the quadrupole formula. If you have a 2-point masses, right? Inspiring. But we could not use this because the quadrupole formula is only valid at low speeds. So we are using this one here, where gamma ij is the KL, is the projection to the TT gates, and TKL is the energy momentum tensor of a number quantum string or a number quantum loop. So if we construct this, what we see is that the 2-0 mode of the plus polarization looks like this. So at t equals to 0, there is nothing here, and then the loop accelerates, and you start to have this signal here. So now, what about matching the infold merger and the ring? So in black line, you can see the simulation, right? So this is the one that we extract from the simulations and we integrate twice. And red one is the weight gravity construction. So the black one, the black line, we cannot trust it here because we have this junk radiation. The weight gravity one, we cannot trust it here because then you form a black hole and you need to know what strong gravity, how strong gravity is affecting the dynamics. But then here, there is some window where these two signals should match. And how do we match them? So as I said, when you integrate twice, you still have this overall shifting freedom, which if you use it here, you see that it beautifully matches here. Right. So this is the way we construct the full signal. So here I'm showing you in dashed line, the weight gravity calculation, and in black, or in solid line, the numerical relativity. So something that you can notice is that if you go to t minus infinity to t plus infinity, there is this permanent shift in the strain. So this is, I mean, it took us some time to trust this and be confident that this was right. But then we agreed that this is gravitational wave memory, which has been studied in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So you can think of this as, imagine that you have your detector arms that have some length, then this gravitational wave passes, and then instead of relaxing to the length that they had before, they have relaxed to a different one. So there is like a permanent shift. And this gravitational wave memory happens because it usually happens when you have energy that is emitted to infinity in a very anisotropic way. So here you can see that it is proportional to the outgoing energy with some velocity and some anisotropy, and the ingoing. So for our case, ingoing, the loop is stationary, so it is zero, so you don't have to worry about this, but as I will show you in the next movie, we have two jets that are emitted along the set direction that are moving at almost the speed of light. So we are gonna have a large contribution from this down here. So if I show you this movie here, let's see. Can you see the movie? I hope you can. Okay, so here I'm showing you the energy density in color here, right? This one here. And then the conformal factor here are the contours. So if you get to conformal factors that are about 0.2, you are forming a black hole. So what you can see is that if I play this, right, the loop starts to collapse. You can already see here how it is Lorentz contracted. Look at this. It has been really Lorentz contracted because it's moving really, really fast, 0.99c in this case. Then you form a black hole. I had some problem here. You form the black hole here, and then there you have these two jets that are emitted along with the set direction. So you have lots of matter that is emitted in a very anisotropic way. And this is the thing that is responsible for the memory. So maybe just to finish my talk, so some ongoing and future work, maybe this is relevant to what you, I mean, what we are trying to do is,
yes. Sorry, before you do this, so there's a formula that relates. So in the nonlinear memory, there's a formula. You know, I mean, it's not quite this formula, but there's a formula that relates the memory to the integrated flux of energy. So it's actually something you can calculate from the flux of energy.
Exactly.
So have you tried to match?
No. We didn't do that. We just wanted to know an order of magnitude of this, so we didn't try to extract what is the flux and integrate that. What we wanted to know is if the order of magnitude is about the same. So here you see that is about 20. So if I take the energy, I know how much energy has been emitted. If I put the velocity at which it's moving, and I know more or less that it's just in set direction, we got about 12, I think, of memory. So I think we were quite satisfied with that, yeah. But I agree that maybe that's the proper way of doing it. Just taking.
Yeah, because I'm wondering. I mean, you're matching between early times and late times. I mean, that must be, you know, very delicate. And your final answer, your final memory will. I mean, the estimated memory will depend, I think, sensitively on exactly how you do that match. So I would,
I think
I would have liked to see something corroborating this this estimate.
Yeah, I mean, the memory depends really on this shift here, and not only that, but also if there is some shift in the time from your numerical simulations. Yeah, I don't think. Yeah. So to be honest, I if you tell me, is this the right quantity for the memory? I don't think I can bet money. I don't think I can say, oh, it's 21 or 18 or 25. But what I can say from this argument and this just easy formula where we can just get some approximation is that we do have quite important memory contribution in these events. But yeah, I don't think I can say, oh, it's exactly that number. Yeah.
Okay, but you're satisfied that in order of magnitude, you have to
write answer. Yeah. I mean, the fact that we found that these events produce memory, I think we were quite happy about that already. But yeah.
Okay, thanks.
No problem. So, okay, so if here I was showing the 2-0 mode, here I'm showing also the 4-0 mode, right? And as I said before, if I just have access to the merger and the or the late ring down, right? Imagine, like think about the GW190521, I think it is. The one that there was a publication, I think, in 2020, in September, or something like that, where we only could see a bit of the merger and the ring down. The question that we want to ask is, okay, this might look like a very massive BBH. So something that we are trying to work with, or something that we are working for some months already with Andrew Williamson, Thomas Helfer, Eugene Lehmann, Samaya Nisanke, is can we use the mode content, right? The fact that you have not only 2-0 mode, but also 4-0 mode, and in binary black holes, you might have the 2-2 mode, to distinguish between very massive BBHs or atypical gravitational wave progenitors, which in this case was a cosmic string loop. But this could totally be also like a, maybe a boson star. And some other thing that we are working on is also trying to extract gravitational waves from other systems. So not circular loops, but maybe a collision of waves in a string. But for now, I think I'm going to finish here. So if I summarize what we have been talking about, so circular cosmic string loops collapse. They accelerate due to relativistic speeds. They come from black holes, as we saw, which produce very specific gravitational wave signal that looks like this with a large contribution of memory. So I think this is all from me. Thank you. And if you have any question, I'm happy to talk more. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think the floor is open for questions.
So Joshua, how about collisions or interactions of loops, or is that expected to be a much lower rate of happening?
So you mean how
different loops colliding or just interacting?
Also, how long it takes to a loop to collapse, you mean?
No. So you discussed two options here, the cost, the circular loop collapsing, yeah. And then towards the end, you were saying the waves propagating on a single loop. So I would consider interaction of different loops, or is that actually considered to be too rare?
Here, I didn't mean to say that this isn't a loop. This could be an string. Yeah. I don't think we have the answer for that. I think that's something that people that do the networks and you know they have all these different phenomena is something that they can study. I don't think I have the answer for that. In terms of how likely this event is, if you mean that, or how often do we expect from this. I think this is something that, I mean, the same way as if we want to know how many black holes collisions we should expect, we should first ask, oh, what is the population of black holes out there? So I think for us, it's really the same. So it depends on the network, how the network evolves. But as I said before, these loops are about solar system size. So they are very small. And what people have seen in the networks is that small loops, there are plenty of them. There are many, many of them. Because as the network is evolving, you are chopping off more and more loops. So you are all the time producing a lot of them. So in our first paper, we did some estimate of what is the rate that we should expect. If all the loops that we have should be circular, what is the rate? I think we got like one per year or one every 2 years. But of course, to do that, we made some assumptions. So, but yeah, this is something that the network people are the right people to that can give the answer to this.
Thank you.
Okay. When the string doesn't form a black hole but just disperses, you still get gravitational waves. Have you calculated for that case? Yeah.
So we try to do that. The problem is that, I mean, this was a computational problem, I think. When you don't have a black hole formation, right, all the energy, all the matter is crossing your detector in your simulation. So I don't think we were not clear how to extract the gravitational waves in that case, because if you are extracting at some distance the energy that is being emitted, like what the waveform is doing, you have coupling to the matter. So it's like these waveforms that I'm showing you here are clean because there is no matter that is messing around with our extraction.
If you calculate psi 4, you should capture just the waves, right?
Yes, but I think it depends what in psi 4 you also have you can have a contribution from the energy density, for example.
Is the problem that your
matter is moving near the speed of light?
Yeah, so exactly. Yeah,
of course. Yeah.
So something that we thought of how to do this is like gravitational waves are massless, right? So they propagate at the speed of light. However, these fields are massive, so they don't propagate at the speed of light. So one thing that we thought of doing, but in the end we focus on black holes, is, okay, if we struck farther enough, we should be able to distinguish, like, extract first the gravitational waves and then the matter fields will arrive later, just because they don't propagate at the speed of light. I think this is something that we tried, but we didn't include here. I don't know if that makes sense, if you think that's a reasonable thing to do. Just because you have different propagation speeds, just start far enough. But yeah.
Could I ask?
So axisymmetry, I think in general, tends to like suppress the gravitational radiation from a system. So if you had a loop that was not completely axisymmetric, I don't know, it was like elliptic or something like that.
Yeah.
Have you considered that, or do you think that would enhance the gravitational radiation or not?
So we did planar loops. I mean, this is one of my bucket slides. You can see here, these are a bit like an ellipse loop, and these are like more like a square. So what we see is that the tension circularizes everything. So the regions that have more curvature have more tension, so they circularize. So as you can see here, okay, let me see if I can show this. What you can see here is that a loop that it is not circular, it is circularizing. So maybe when you form the black hole, the loop is approximately circular again. So you don't see that problem.
But the energy density distribution seems different, right?
Yes, but if you wait until the end, right? Now a different question is, okay, in this case, we are still considering planar loops. What if the loop is not planar anymore? Right, if you have something that looks like this, I don't know if you can see. So instead of just being planar, you have something that has some angle. The reason why we haven't done that is just because getting initial data for that is hard. It would also be nice to boost a loop, right? Like give some angular momenta so we can deform it. But we haven't. I think that's much harder because you also have to solve the momentum constraints. Yeah. This is what we found for non-circular loops.
Have you extracted the waveforms in this case?
In this case, no, we haven't. Actually. No, so maybe we should.
I mean, there is, as you say, well, towards the end looks very spherical, but of course we're looking at a very, very narrow region. But towards the end, you still see
more
towards the X than to in the opposite direction.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, actually. I mean, in the end, we had enough to write the paper, but I think this might be interesting to look at. Yeah, just, I mean, it's easy. It's really just extracting the same waveform, so it shouldn't be hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
So Daniel, you still have a question?
Yes, I have a. My question was concerning rates, and you partially answered that already. But I just wanted to ask if you could maybe expand on that a little bit. So, how do you compute rates for these events? And so, how many events do we expect for, say, the LIGO band versus LISA band or DeSigo band? And if you say that there's so many of them, how do you distinguish them from the background?
Oh, I don't know if I can show something there. Yeah. So when people do networks, right? So if I go to this first slide, I mean, this is a quite small network here, the one that I'm showing you here. But when people do networks in Ambugoto, what they can do is count how many loops of different radius they have. So they have some production function, like how many loops are you forming? So what we did to construct or to get some number for our rates was knowing, okay, what is this production rate that we have and how far are we, or how many loops? Oh, shit, I don't have it. I used to have another slide. Okay, maybe I don't have it. So what we did is literally taking Earth. We know how loud these events are. So we know how far we can observe from there. Then take this loop density number that we have from network simulations and know how many of them we have around the sphere from us. And literally we took that number and saw that we should get like one per year. But of course, for doing this, we have to make some assumptions, like assuming that all of these loops that people see in networks will circularize and will be circular. Because if they are not circular, they might not collapse to a black hole. So what we did was getting the loop number density, knowing how far we can observe, and literally that was the number we got for. We took into account the redshift in terms of how far can we observe, but the change was really, really small. So I don't think it matters. And for the LISA band, So for the LISA band, the only thing that changes is that you are looking at different masses of black holes. What is it? You are seeing, instead of 100, I think it's 10 to the 6, much more. The only difference with that is that your loops need to be larger, but still, they are not going to be Hubble size. So what people see in their network simulations is that you have as many loops of this radius that are 10 to the 3 times larger than these ones. So the difference is not big. So I don't think LISA is a huge improvement for looking for these things. That's what I would say. Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. So excuse me. So you're essentially saying it's a scale invariant problem.
Yes. So this happens for single loops only.
Okay. So for these network simulations, how do you set the initial conditions there? Because it seems like the loop density must be some sort of function of what you assume as initial conditions there to start with.
I don't know because I have not done any network simulation, but what I think they do is they simulate this, the phase transition. So you have some random fields that you set along the potential that you have, and then you form these loops. I should say that in these cases, they don't take into account GR, and the networks that people mostly believe are the ones from Nambugoto. So I think there are also many caveats there, because if you introduce field interactions and gravity, maybe your loop number density will change. But I cannot say more. I don't think this is a solved problem, to be honest. Different models of networks have different number loop number densities. Yeah.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you.
No problem. But yeah, I mean, don't take this very seriously what I'm saying, because I don't know much about networks. I know the basics, yeah.
Right, but do you have a sense of how these loop number densities change depending on the approach?
So right now in Nambugoto, right? I think I have this here. So even within Nambugoto, there are two main approaches. So if you look at the LIGO paper that studies constraints on cosmic strings, you see that there will be three models that do Nambugoto: model A, model B, and model C. Some of them two of them quite agree on the loop number density, so their constraints are the same, But there is a third one that predicts 10 to the 5 more loops. So it's really a huge change. And I don't think there is an agreement between them. I think they are still discussing that. But the fact that you have many more loops, what makes it you is put stronger constraints. So that's why when I was putting here the constraints here, where is it? You see that I wrote 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 10. Because for one model, which produces less loops, your constraints are not as tight as for the other one. So yeah, there can be a factor of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 in these different network simulations. That's what I would say, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
No problem.
Okay, so I guess it's about time. So let's thank Joshu for the nice talk.
Thank you, yeah. Thank you for inviting. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, very nice talk, very nice.